Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program is sponsored tonight by the Business and Leadership member-led forum. Christy Daines is here tonight, who's vice chair of the Business and Leadership Forum. Our program is Restoring the Mighty Colorado and Its Delta, Progress and Hope. It is my pleasure to introduce our wonderful panel. John Shepherd, who's from the Sonoran Institute in Tucson, Arizona. Jill Tidman, who's executive director of the Redford Center, and he is also a documentary producer. Andrew Falland, who's deputy director of California Water Foundation. And they will share with you their concepts and what has been happening in actions on the restoring of the Colorado River. And Jill, shall I turn it over to you to get started?
Sure. We were going to start you off with a short film called Renewal. And apparently we can't turn down the lights, unfortunately, but we'll watch anyway.
Witnessing the forces of nature at work, there's nothing like it. When allowed, nature has immense power to restore its own balance, find its own rhythm with the world as it should be, and with all the creatures that inhabit it. This is the awesome process that has just occurred in the Colorado River Delta.
It was an amazing experience to see the river coming alive again.
We demonstrated that it's possible.
This is a precedent. This is a model that people are watching from all over the world.
One of the great rivers of the world, the Colorado River flows some 1,450 miles from the western slopes of the Colorado Rockies onward to its delta. 100 years ago, the delta was a massive, lush region spanning more than 3,000 square miles, filled with native vegetation and home to more than 300 species of birds and animals that supported a way of life for the people who lived there.
It seems strange that you would have all of these green, lush areas growing in the middle of the desert, but that's exactly what used to be here, you know, 100 years ago.
The Colorado River is North America's great desert river, but for the last 50 years, it has not reached its delta or the sea, instead draining away into a sandy desert south of the Mexican border. The parched and withered delta is just a whisper of its former self. The unrelenting quest by humans to grow and tame the forces of nature are largely responsible for its plight. Layer on the effects of a changing climate, and we have a catastrophic natural disaster on our hands. Humans can certainly harm, but humans can also help. Inspired by nature's resilience and the knowledge that a small amount of water can rekindle life, a bi-national restoration effort in the Delta was launched in the 1990s. The work of nonprofit groups, government agencies, community leaders, and others helped inspire an historic agreement in 2012 between the governments of Mexico and the United States. Called Minute 319, the U.S. and Mexico agreed that working together to save the Delta with more regular water flows was an important priority.
We, as citizens of the Colorado River watershed, decided that this is what we wanted to do, and we made it happen.
In March 2014, the time for action had come. Beginning at the Morelos Dam, located on the U.S.-Mexico border, an unprecedented surge of water called a pulse flow began its historic journey into the Delta, an event intended to mimic the natural spring flooding that used to take place annually in this region. As the gates of the dam opened, U.S. and Mexican officials celebrated the beginning of this unique experiment. Years of work had cemented a new binational partnership, a model of cooperation for all the world to see.
We were there to witness, knowing when they opened the gates and the river was alive, and it's a complete excitement to everybody.
Watching the water surge past the dam and discovering once again its rightful path towards the sea was a sight to behold.
We weren't just running a demonstration, we were creating a river.
How often have humans witnessed a river being reborn? Inch by inch, foot by foot, mile by mile, in an awesome demonstration of the force of nature, the Colorado River was reclaiming its corridor.
It's a fantastic feeling to have a river running again.
Within days, the surge of fresh water had transformed a dry riverbed at San Luis Rio, Colorado, a small Mexican community south of the border, into a river almost 8 feet deep in parts.
Most of the time, the riverbed is dry, but as you can see now, you know, there is water coming in the river, and you know, the water attracts people from the local communities here. So that's why this area is very important, because people get connected again with the river. You know, kids especially, they haven't seen the water here, so this might be the first time for them to see water here in the river.
The response of the people was amazing. I think that was probably the best surprise, you know, how the communities embrace the river coming back.
Astonished to find a river in their neighborhood, children and families celebrated the return of water and all the joy a natural resource can bring.
Yo lo considero así, fuera una bendición que pudiéramos tener agua ya constantemente aquí en el río Colorado.
La agua es vida.
The local reaction to seeing the river conjured back to life in the Delta was really beyond all of our expectations.
8 weeks later, on May 15th, 2014, the water pulse reached the sea in an exhilarating reconnection, an event that had not happened regularly in at least half a century. From the air, it appeared as if the tidal waters of the upper Gulf of California extended its salty fingers to touch, once again, the cool, fresh water of the Colorado River. Despite all the obstacles, nature had found a way. History was made. The magnificent forces of nature were hard at work once again, for all to see. Water-laden air attracted birds and wildlife to the region like a magnet. It was an invitation to congregate. Recently planted native cottonwoods and willows sprang to life, launching their seedlings in a slow-motion dance. Given the experimental nature of the pulse flow, it will take time to fully understand its benefits and impact on the region.
While the scientists are going to have much to tell us over the next few years about what the ecosystem response is and the groundwater response and how the water moved through the river, a lot of what we had to learn from the pulse flow is what we saw in the human response to what it looked like to move that water into that river channel again.
Of the 260 rivers that cross or form international boundaries, this is the world's first water allocation for the environment.
We had the opportunity today to build on our binational partnership to make water flows to the Delta region a regular occurrence once again. The future of this region's economy depends on it, as do the lives of the people and communities near the river.
we had two countries, the United States and Mexico, coming together in a collaborative way saying, we are deliberately going to put some of this river's water to use to support nature, to support a healthy river, and to support everything that lives depending on that river.
It's the beginning of a whole new process, no? To show that we are in a new era of the Colorado River.
Join us in this unique effort to restore life to the Delta. Help us continue the positive change underway. Share the excitement that has captivated people on both sides of the border. You too can become part of this restoration effort. Learn more at raisetheriver.org.
For the audience on the internet and radio, I'm sure you all understood that the documentary was narrated by Robert Redford. And we'll turn it back over to our panel now. And thank you to Robert Redford. This, I actually want personally to tell you, was one of the most inspiring pictures and video that I've ever seen, that the river actually flowed again. It meant a lot to me because I have connections with Colorado and know the river. So for me, it was very deep. Jill?
Great. Well, I think this is a really exceptional way to kick off our evening tonight. And I want to welcome all of you to the Commonwealth Club. In reflecting on the title, Progress and Hope, I think we can obviously see illustrations of both here. This was an important beginning step, I think. We're going to hear from two people who have been involved in these efforts, both from the perspective of really the more technical and legal side, as well as the creative and artistic side, just to remind everyone, I'm Andrew Folland with the California Water Foundation, and I'm really here serving in the role of MC, but also to try to tie this back to and make relevant to those of us here in California. We, of course, share a piece of the Colorado River, an important piece, but up here in San Francisco, we might not think of it. If we think of a delta at all, it's the one just to the east of us. So I want to start off, first of all, I want to invite everyone who's here to participate in this conversation. We're certainly planning to have time at the end for questions and answers, but I want to actually invite and encourage people to chime in, raise your hand, ask questions as we go. This is really meant to be as much a dialogue as anything else.
Just a quick reminder, if we dialogue, be sure and raise your hand so I can get the microphone to you. If we don't have it on the microphone, we'll lose it in the recording. So what I'll do is I'll stand over here, and if you make questions or answer questions, just, wave to me as the program goes on. And for our radio audience, again, just to remind everyone, this is Restoring the Mighty Colorado and Its Delta, Progress and Hope, with John Shepherd, the Sonoran Institute in Tucson, Arizona, Jill Tidman, Executive Director of the Redford Center, documentary producer for what we just saw, and Andrew Farland, Deputy Director, California Water Foundation, who's going to be our coordinator and moderator tonight. So back to you, Andrew.
Thank you. John, I want to turn to you first, and I wondered if you could, we heard a little bit about sort of how this came about, but I wonder if you could sort of elaborate a little
Sure.
bit on the circumstances that led up to this restoration effort.
Right. Well, this has been something that's been in the works for about 25 years. I've been with the Sonoran Institute for 19 years, and so been working on this for quite a while. And I thought I'd flesh out the story just a little bit more, just so that everyone's kind of on the same page and gets a deeper appreciation for this pulse flow and what's happening in the Delta. So with the construction of the Glen Canyon Dam in the late 1960s, you know, the ability to store Colorado River water increased phenomenally. And that meant that the water that went to Mexico could be stored behind those, both the Lake Mead and Lake Powell. And so increasingly water was not making it down to the Delta or the Upper Gulf of California. And, you know, within 10 years or so, you know, people really thought the Delta was a lost cause. What happened was in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there were a series of significant late winter storms that created so much rain, and I know this is going to be hard to believe, that they couldn't store it all in Lake Mead. And so they had to essentially let that water go down the river and go all the way to Mexico. And so suddenly water was making it down for, albeit brief times, down to the Delta. Well, scientists on both the U.S. and Mexico side were really intrigued to find out, well, was that having any impact on the Delta? And so for a number of years, scientists went down there and did field explorations around the main stem of the Colorado River, and lo and behold, that water was having a profound transformative effect on the Delta, that it was sort of springing back to life. And it got scientists and agency folks on both sides of the border talking about, well, you know, maybe there's potential here to restore the Colorado River Delta, not to what it used to be, but key portions of it. And so for a number of years, scientists worked down there to try to identify which portions of the Delta sort of would lend themselves to restoration and how much water would be needed. They identified a series of sort of conservation priorities for the Delta, an important first step. And then Sonoran Institute and our partners in Mexico, ProNatura Noroeste in particular, started to do a little bit of, you know, very active restoration and started to deliver some water that they acquired from willing sellers in the Mexicali Valley to see whether with a little bit of water and a little bit of more active restoration, we could start to see some changes. And lo and behold, even more restoration potential sort of arose from that. We worked a lot with communities around there, helping to educate them as to what used to be there. I mean, think about it, 50 years, that's a lot of generations that never experienced water in that river. And so educating to them the history, the potential there, you know, we did everything from cleanup waste along the river. We did education programs, Adopt a River, with local schools there. We worked with eco camps. There's a significant hunting economy down there, and a lot of hunters from the U.S. go down to hunt in the winter waterfowls, and getting them more engaged in that. We started a native plant nursery down there to grow the little saplings and seedlings that we would need to do the restoration work. And people start, in Mexico in particular, started to take note of what was happening down there. And we had the state agencies from Baja, from Sonora coming down and giving their support and imprimatur, and then the federal government got involved in that. And about that time, the U.S. NGOs were pushing very hard to get Mexico more engaged in discussions about managing the Colorado River. It may be not too surprising, but Mexico was essentially the one player left out of a lot of basin-wide discussions. And in 2007, there was a minute or an amendment to the treaty for the Colorado River, and a big effort was made by U.S. enviro groups to get Mexico involved. A little hesitation on the U.S. side, but we started talking to the folks at the federal level in Mexico, and they increasingly got interested. So by the time this treaty was signed in 2012, the Mexican federal government was actually the one pushing the treaty to make it happen. They were saying restoring the Delta was our number one conservation priority in Mexico. And all of that came from, you know, the first work that was done in the field, working with communities, showing how restoration could happen. And so the minute was signed finally in 2012. And part of, there are many really precedent-setting aspects of the treaty, and we can talk a little bit about that. But the one you saw was the Pulse Flow, an agreement that both the U.S. and Mexico would allow about 102,000 acre-feet of water to come down over a six-week period to Mexico and into the Delta. Very difficult to pull off. There was a lot of work that had to be done very quickly because the agreement was signed in November, and then the next spring we had to be ready to do the restoration. There was a lot of active and passive restoration work, pulling out invasives, getting all the saplings ready, dredging and connecting meanders to the main part of the river. A lot of work went into that, and, you know, as you can see from the community response, that alone makes it a success. But we're learning about what the Pulse Flow did, and we're going to be learning more about it over the years to come, and we can share some of the initial findings this evening. But hopefully that fleshed it out a little bit, maybe not too much.
No, I think that's terrific. It obviously takes an enormous a deal of patience and coordination and effort among a lot of organizations, a lot of individuals. So John, you alluded a little bit to the results of what mm-hmm. you've seen so far, and clearly, was said in the video, that it's going to take a while to sort of measure up mm-hmm. exactly what we saw. First of all, what are some of the preliminary results in addition to the kids having
right.
a great time splashing around? What are some of the preliminary results we're starting to see? What kind of mechanisms do we have in place mm-hmm. to sort of measure and determine what has happened?
Right. So first of all, as part of the Minute Agreement, both governments agreed to set up a science committee, by National Science Committee, that sort of establish all the monitoring protocols. How are we going to measure this? How are we going to define success? And so all of that's kind of been set up. So it's really going to be subject to pretty rigorous analysis. So that's an important thing to just sort of say at the outset. So, you know, what we've learned so far is in areas where we did a lot of active restoration, and by active restoration we're talking about pulling out invasives, we're talking about planting seedlings and saplings, we're seeing some pretty dramatic results. I mean, trees growing up to 5 feet as a result of the Pulse Flow. The water made it down to many of the conservation or restoration priority sites, so that was good. And then, as the video said, 1% of that water, about 1,000 acre feet, actually made it down to the upper portion of the estuary and the upper Gulf of California. So there's a hint of the potential for connecting the river to the sea. Some of the things we're learning is, you know, there was an earthquake in the Mexicali region in 2010, and that affected the whole hydrology sort of underneath the delta. And we're learning that we suspected that it probably changed a lot of the hydrology, and so we're learning a little bit more about how that's going to affect the flow of water. More water went underground than we had hoped, and we thought more water would reach the restoration sites. But even when that water goes underground, it still starts to, you know, continues to migrate downward and can have a significant impact on root systems and all that. So there's a lot more to be learned over the next few years. We saw also a lot more shorebirds and migratory birds landing at the various restoration sites, not only because there was vegetation, but because there were large pools of water, which they need. So that also augurs well for sort of creating important stopovers for migratory birds making it up from South and Central America in the springtime.
That's great. And so what do you anticipate additional experiments that are going to take place over the next few years?
So the agreement is a five-year agreement, so from 2012 to 2017. And that agreement only allowed for one pulse flow. So our hope is, if we're able to continue to document the success and the impact of the pulse flow, that there'll be consideration of at least another pulse flow if they decide to renew this agreement for another 5 years. There's a lot of stuff that will play into that next agreement, not the least of which is the potential of a shortage declaration on the Colorado River, which kind of changes both the political and water equation. But I think right now there's reason to be optimistic that another pulse flow will happen.
So the first pulse flow certainly didn't happen without sort of active enthusiasm and encouragement from folks, and you mentioned some folks in the environmental community here in the United States, as well as people within Mexico. The Redford Center has been involved in this project and has been active in trying to raise awareness. And Jill, what was it about this project that got the Redford Center excited and interested and involved?
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, so the Redford Center, we do a lot of storytelling through content production, and we had been making a film. The Redford family have deep connections to the river and very much identify themselves as Westerners and have great concern for what's going on with water in the West. And so part of their contribution as engaged citizens is trying to help get the word out about some of these issues. So we had been in production on a film called Watershed that Anne was plugging earlier. Thank you, Anne. And in that process met John's colleague, Edith Santiago, who is one of the people working on the restoration sites down in the Delta. And through Edith, we learned of the work that was happening, but also of the solution that was on the table, which was the Minute 319. And at the time, it hadn't been signed, but everybody was saying it was going to be signed. And once it was, there was a real opportunity for, not just the pulse flow, but restoration that was going to be and something that was put in place for the long term. So as John was describing, the U.S. and Mexico both have had a responsibility within the minute, but the NGO community has a responsibility within that minute, too, and our responsibility is to restore about 2,300 acres of land and habitat and to purchase about 52,000 acre-feet of water. Acquire and deliver to these restoration sites. And so the good news is it to do that work is not a lot of money, relatively speaking. And so we were very interested in supporting the five organizations that had been part of this coalition doing the work by helping them get the word out in sort of a more unified way. And so we brought them all to Sundance and asked the question, do you guys want this umbrella campaign, Raise the River? And it was unanimously yes, and then we went through the exercise, do we want it to be raising money, raising awareness, or both? And we all said both. And so thus we started this Raise the River Coalition sort of more formally. We're not a nonprofit 501c3, we're a loose, coalition of six groups. And so the Redford Center is sort of the newest player in the mix, I would say. But we feel so strongly that this is an opportunity for education, awareness raising, and for the public to be part of this historic move that's happening. And this model really is being looked at as a replicable model, not just for the work that's happening, but the NGO involvement in these binational treaties. And for us, as a storytelling tool, if you tell anybody that the Colorado River doesn't reach the sea anymore, most people, if they're not involved in the issues or already engaged, they don't know. And it sort of stops them in their tracks, and it's almost that's all they need to hear to know there's a problem. You don't need to get into the science, or you can sort of meet them where they're at and then also give them a way to participate. So really Raise the River is a sort of a fundraising channel. And we have a beautiful website that we just relaunched this summer. Anybody can even just give $5 and be able to say, I was part of this thing. And we're going to make it happen. Our first fundraising milestone was to raise $10 million. We've been at it about a year and a half. We've raised about $9.3 million. And as soon as we hit that, we'll probably put another $5 million milestone out there. We have till 2017 to raise it. But for us, it's a win-win-win. It's an honor to be involved in it, and it's just been a really exciting project. I've been down to the Delta twice, and I very rarely get to touch the work, when you make films, you just sort of hope things happen. But to be able to go down and see, as John said, this habitat bursting back to life is pretty incredible. So.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, Restoring the Mighty Colorado and Its Delta, Progress and Hope, with John Shepherd from the Sonoran Institute in Tucson, Arizona, Jill Tidman, Executive Director at the Redford Center, and our coordinator and moderator, Andrew Fallon, Deputy Director of California Water Foundation.
So Jill, you've described these sort of dual goals. Tell us a little bit more about sort of where things are headed with this campaign and what you're hoping to achieve over the next few years.
Yeah, well, I mean, as John said, it's really, it's about the work on the ground and making sure that we raise the money, get to do the restoration work, and deliver the water. And so for us, it's really about getting the money in and also getting more people involved. And so, you know, one of the things we'll show you next is a short video that we produced with Bob Redford and Will Ferrell, sort of debating the best solution for restoring this river. Maybe some of you have been hearing chuckles, maybe some of you have seen it. But, you know, for us it was a way to just get the word out about this and make it more fun, make it more accessible, relevant to what's going on today. And so, you know, we had quite a few eyeballs on that one, which is good. So, yeah, we're always working on that awareness and fundraising. Those are sort of the twin goals.
So should we take a look?
Yeah, let's take a look.
The Colorado River is one of the most loved and hardest working rivers in the world. But we've overused it. Most years the river dries up even before it reaches the sea. By adding just a small amount of water to the river's flow, we can help bring life back to the wetlands and marshes in the Delta. So please, would you join me in raisetheriver.org and find out how you can get involved?
Hello there. Hello there. I'm William Ferrell. Recently, we've been hearing some talk of a little problem in the Colorado River Delta. We got old Sundance riding around, trying to raise the Colorado River and restore its flow. And I say, do we really need more river? I mean, hell, we got plenty of ocean. Let's move it. Let's reconnect these things the old-fashioned way, the American way. The way to fix this thing is to send money so myself and some other scientists can begin the process of moving a small portion of the ocean back toward the wet part of the river, from there to there. Now go to movetheocean.org and send us your money.
Hello, Mr. Farrell. Thank you for your attention. But let's keep the focus on the wetlands and the wildlife and the people of the Delta region.
You're concerned about the migration patterns of the rufous-sided towhee? You know what I'm concerned about? Surfers. Specifically, American professional surfers. They suffer from a lack of adequate surfable coastline in North America and are forced to travel great distances to enter surf competitions in places like Fiji, Hawaii, Brazil, really far away, okay? We owe it to these fine men and women to move the ocean a few hundred miles in, creating more beach, more waves. Hey, Kelly, how would you feel about more ocean?
Yeah, it sounds great. Love it.
See? He'd love it.
Move the ocean.
I don't think they want to sing. Movetheocean.org.
Hello, Mr. Farrell. I understand very well that you're one of America's most beloved entertainers.
And you sure are in my book. And that's good. Good for you. And that's why I'm sending you this message. Seek help, Will. Soon. You need it. I'm hoping for your health. And so is America.
Listen, Bob. Robert. While I admire your passion for the earth and I loved you in Dances with the Wolves, when it comes to restoring the Delta, you're out of your league, all right? You want people to listen to facts and science, and that's not what this is about. MoveTheOcean.org is about a little something called American ingenuity and pull yourself up by your bootstrappedness. The ocean is big, vast, maybe a little too big for old Sundance. Is that what it is? You intimidated by a little salt water? Can't swim? Is that why you live high up there in the mountains? Huh? Huh, Bob? You a big mountain man? Are you tough? You like to grow a big beard in the wintertime and then shave it for the summer? You like to wear fringe leather jackets? Is that what you're all about? You can Robert Redford. You can eat a lot of it.
Oh, God. Look, whatever your position on this is, please join us in our effort to complete the river's journey to its destination. It will take so little. And with your help, it can be done. Help reconnect the Colorado River. Text Delta to 52000 and donate $10 to the Delta Water Trust today.
Think about it. 400 miles of new oceanfront property, live workspace, tiki bars, high rent condominiums. MoveTheOcean.org. Send me money instead.
So. Mr. Farrell, you know, makes a compelling argument, but I hope that Mr. Redford made a more compelling one. What's the result so far?
Yeah, well, we do have a movetheocean.org website and a fundraising page, and they've raised about $1,000, and we're at about 28,000, so we're winning in that game.
And that 1,000 does ultimately come to raise the river.
That's
just
correct.
In case people
just
were wondering.
Just in case you're wondering, it all goes actually through John's organization to the Water Trust.
Very good, very good. So tell us a little bit about other projects that the Redford Center is working on right now. Is this the primary project that you guys are doing?
We are in production on another film right now about sort of the grassroots emergence of clean energy technology that's happening in this country. We're taking a look at sort of the climate story through that lens, really trying to tell a more hopeful solutions-based progress story on that. But, you know, for us, it's always trying to connect the dots, too. And so, you know, even in Watershed, we had an energy water piece and, you know, really just feeling like it's got to be a more holistic discussion.
Well, if we don't have more renewable energy, Will Ferrell's dream may just come true, right?
That's right.
So, John, back to you for a second. So the prospects for another agreement with Mexico, you've alluded to this, that we're due for effectively a renewal here. What are some of the challenges that stand in the way of a successful agreement at this point?
You know, I think the biggest challenges are going to be external factors. So we can start with ongoing drought in the Colorado River Basin. Even the drought in California could affect public perception and influence whether or not another agreement happens. If a shortage declaration is called, so if Lake Mead falls beyond yet the low point it is now down to, do you remember how much it is? It's like,
I'm
Anyway, there's a critical threshold. If it falls below that, the Secretary of the Interior calls a shortage, and that requires everybody to kind of begin to share the pain in terms of using less water. That could also influence it. You know, relations between the U.S. and Mexico, the whole immigration issue, there are equally controversial issues in the Rio Grande watershed, which is a shared watershed there, that could also influence and maybe detrimentally influence the discussions here. So there are a lot of external factors that could play. I think the good news is there are so many precedents that are being set with Minute 319 that have broader applicability to the basin, relevant to, you know, Southern California's water users that use Colorado River water, that, you know, the details, the technical aspects of putting an agreement together are kind of easy. It's the politics that are really going to ultimately determine whether this moves forward. Now, you know, the discussions are going to start probably next year for an agreement that would come into place in 2017. And obviously, the current administration, which has been extremely supportive of this work, wants to sort of get that agreement nailed before it leaves office, so you can have a sense of what the real timeline is for putting another agreement together.
So what are some of the lessons that you've drawn that you might share that could be transferable or translatable from having been involved in this effort for as long as you have?
Well, I mean, to be my most Pollyannish, I would say the first thing is, you know, that the natural environment is resilient and that restoration is possible in many areas. Again, you won't achieve the scale or maybe even the quality of what the Delta was before, but some important restoration work can be done that benefits the environment, that benefits communities, that helps nurture economic activities in those communities. So there's tremendous potential in nature to be resilient. So that's, I think, the first thing. You know, the other thing is that the environmental community really stepped up here. You know, so before the 2012 agreement, there was a 2007 agreement that just applied to the U.S. side, and it introduced a lot of innovative concepts in terms of when do you start to share the pain before a shortage happens, so try to forestall that. A lot of those ideas came from the environmental community. I like to say they pushed the ideas, the paper, underneath the door in the room where all the water buffaloes were negotiating that agreement. For 2012, the door was wide open and we were handing things in through the door. And at the next agreement, the environmental community is going to be a part of that. And they were not only a part of crafting the agreement and coming up a lot with the innovative ideas, they're responsible. They're on the hook to help a lot of the implementation of Minute 319. The environmental community, the members of Raise the River, are on the hook to deliver, in addition to the 102,000 acre-feet of pulse flow water, 52,000 acre-feet of water that's sort of what they call a base flow, a continuous flow of water to the restoration sites. And that's being done through a water trust that we've established in Mexico. It's the first water trust dedicated to conservation work. It's been acquiring water in the Mexicali Valley from willing sellers at under $500 an acre feet. Yes, $500. Very different than the United States. We've acquired about 4,600 acre feet of water. We're hoping to be at about 10 to 11,000 acre feet. But we're on the hook for that. And we're on the hook for the on-the-ground restoration work. So we, you know, I feel like we are equal partners with both the U.S. and the Mexican federal government, the water management agencies in the basin, and the state representatives. And I think that that kind of leadership is really precedent-setting. You know, we advocate for stuff, but then typically others, generally public agencies, are responsible for carrying out most of the work. In this case, I feel like we're doing a lot of the heavy lifting, and so that's another thing. And then, you know, the hopeful message of seeing U.S. and Mexico actually working constructively to a positive outcome. I mean, so much of what we hear about is so negative. It's mostly driven by the immigration debate. So to me, all of that are positives. I will, again, make the more explicit point in terms of why it's relevant to California. One of the neat aspects of Minute 319 is that the irrigation system, so the delivery system for water to farmers in the Mexicali Valley, as you might imagine, is a pretty inefficient system. It's mostly dirt ditches. And then when the Mexicali earthquake happened in 2010, it further undermined the irrigation system. So it's not an efficient system for delivering water to grow crops. So as part of Minute 319, water management agencies in the U.S. agreed to help line a lot of those canals down there. And in return for some of the water saved, that water will go to U.S. water agencies to use. So for a whole lot less money to improve the efficiency of the irrigation system there, they get water, Mexico's water that's stored in Lake Mead that they can use for their own purposes. That kind of innovation, which again the Enviro community was a strong advocate for, are the kinds of things that, you know, we'll see in the next agreement and will have a profound impact on water users in Southern California.
So at this time, I want to take any of your questions. Anyone have questions, please raise your hand. Anne will be around with the microphone.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we are now really ready to ask those questions, and we have a number of hands that have gone up. And our panel again is Jill Tidman, who is Executive Director of the Redford Center, and John Shepherd from the Sonoran Institute, Tucson, Arizona, and our coordinator and moderator, Andrew Fallon from, Deputy Director, California Water Foundation. Sorry for the frog in my voice, which I hope finds water soon. So.
Yes, I have a couple questions about the hard facts of water resources involved here. First of all, I'd like to know what fraction this is. We talk about 50,000 acre feet or whatever. Is that per year? And what fraction is that of our present water shortfall? And then as a consequence of that, I presume it's a rather small fraction, but we're told by our leaders that every drop counts. So I wonder what plans you are making for being able to continue this activity if we have further shortfalls. You alluded to the fact that, you know, that would raise problems. What have you planned for it, and what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is there any, who gets the benefit out of this? Are there any recreational uses or just looking at wildlife? Mm-hmm.
Great question. So the 52,000 acre feet is a delivery over a five-year period. That water will be provided through water that's acquired in Mexico through the Delta Water Trust. And they acquire that water in perpetuity. So they have that right to then use that acre feet of water on an annual basis. That amount, that 52,000 acre feet of water, if you think of it in terms of annualized, that's 2,000 acre feet a year? No, 10, thank you. I did more math in high school. That's an infinitesimal amount of water in terms of the entire water budget of the Colorado River. That water is acquired, willing seller. It's a right that then remains with the Water Trust, and they'll get to use it in perpetuity. If there's a shortage declaration, the shortage will affect all users, and it affects them in different ways, and I'm really not well-versed enough to explain that, but it will have an impact on the overall allocation of water that goes to Mexico, some of which might then affect the water trust, you know, for a temporary basis. In terms of the benefits right now, we're doing a lot of monitoring to sort of determine those. Obviously, there are environmental benefits in terms of creation of habitat. There are recreational benefits. A lot of folks from Mexicali, one of the largest cities in Mexico, they go down to the Delta to recreate. They water sports, they hunt. Bird watching is actually a nascent but growing activity down there. There are We are now looking actually at tying Delta restoration to a range of other economic activities more broadly, not just in the Delta, but in some of the adjacent communities. There's a lot of interest in promoting additional tourism. You know, there's a significant amount of medical tourism, people who go down for the day or for short stays in Mexico. We've actually done studies to see whether they would be willing to pay $50, $70, $100 to do a tour of the Delta. And about $70 is sort of the average willingness to pay for a day tour. So we're looking to make additional connections to that. There's a native group, the Cucupa. They're split between the U.S. and Mexico, but their heartland is in the Delta. Putting water back in the river there helps them with their subsistence activities and helps their local economy thrive further. So we're beginning to document it, and I think the benefits could be multiple, in addition to the public health benefits of having clean water in the river.
And our next question will be?
Thank you all for sharing your expertise with us tonight. Just to give us a sense of how big the benefit of this activity is, what were the, quote, natural flow conditions, you know, over the past 1,000 years, and how much is the ecosystem used to such extreme variability in the amount of water? And second, since you mentioned reconnecting meanders and so on and so forth, how much of that activity is being done by people in Mexico so the jobs are tied directly to the activity?
Yeah, so all the jobs are in Mexico, and local folks, you know, everything from the native nursery to the actual eco camps and parks that we're setting up to doing the physical dredging, planting, and all that is done by people there. I think we, at one time, this preparing for the Pulse Flow, I think we had about 40 people on just our Mexico office payroll. So there are definitely direct, tangible benefits. I can't answer some of those 1,000-year questions. I can say that more than 90% of the Delta is gone. We're looking to restore, you know, maintain about 10 to 12% of it. Yes, the water, you know, was subject to pulse flows and flooding conditions as well as sort of an ongoing amount of water. That's about all I can tell you.
Hi, I wondered for the water portion, the potential for reclaimed water explored, whether it be from portions of municipal wastewater treatment plants, perhaps agricultural tailwater runoff, or even those rare, probably in that area, stormwater runoff events?
So thank you for asking that question, because that allows me to speak about another project that our group is working on. It doesn't fall within the purview of Minute 319, but it is part of the Delta. The Mexicali Wastewater Treatment Plant a few years ago was working at overcapacity, and so it was discharging untreated effluent into one of the tributaries of the Colorado River called the Rio Hardy, which is west of the river and connects with the main stem of the river just above the estuary. We were able to raise funds to build an artificial wetland that provided additional treatment capacity to the wastewater treatment plant, about 200 acres. They'd like us to build more if we can raise the money. In return for that, we receive about 13,000 acre feet of treated effluent dedicated to restoration projects in the Rio Hardy that we're overseeing. So a really nice quid pro quo there. Upgrade the treatment capacity of the wastewater. In return, get some of that treated effluent that we're using to do restoration work. So we're hoping if we can raise the money to upgrade it further, that commitment, some commitment would be permanent in terms of that. And that treated effluent would be then donated to the water trust, and they would be able to use it as they see fit.
And Andrew, for you, what would you comment on that?
Well, I guess the question is an excellent one and reflects actually strategies that you can find increasingly employed throughout California as well as the arid West. Just to repeat what was asked, are there ways to take either treated wastewater or captured stormwater, other sources of reclaimed water to be used for environmental restoration purposes. And increasingly, that's the one of the most cost-effective, least controversial ways in which we are finding for putting water back in rivers and streams. So you can find that in urban environments, actually not very far from here, and as well as in agricultural areas, rural areas as well. So.
Thank you so much for the excellent presentation and the good work, the fabulous visuals by the Redford Center and the video in the Sonoran Institute, and your moderating. I have a question about the year-round flow through the Delta. As I understand, it's about an 80-mile stretch below the border. Does it get wet in the winter due to winter rains, so there is water in the Delta a few months every winter, or is it dry year-round? Secondly, when you have that 10,000 acre feet, when would it be released throughout the year?
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, the new government of Mexico is under Diaz, different than the previous president who worked on a minute with us. What are the politics of Mexico in the future?
I'll answer that last question first. Happily, both at the federal level and the state level, because there's turnover at both levels, we retain strong support. And so they're eager to sit down with their U.S. counterparts and begin negotiating an additional agreement. Unfortunately, the Delta is so parched that when there are either monsoons, so the Delta is part of sort of the larger Sonoran Desert ecoregion, and one of the things that distinguishes the Sonoran Desert is it has two rainy seasons. It has, historically, gentle winter rains that tend to be sustained and a little more prolonged, and then these intense monsoon rains in the summer. For the most part, those storms don't appreciably increase water in the sense of, you know, making a difference from a restoration standpoint or groundwater, adding more to the groundwater levels there. So it's really going to depend on pulse flows and base flows. And you asked about the base flow. So the way the base flow is working is that when we identify an area for restoration and we've done the active restoration work and we've planted everything, then we are delivering water. It may not be, you know, 365 days a year, but constant enough to promote growth and particularly to allow the root systems to establish. They can get down to a level where then they're tapping into existing groundwater levels, and so we don't have to continue to provide just that base flow to that restoration site. We can then start to use that somewhere else. So it will change as restoration sites are established, the vegetation is established, and we can use that water elsewhere and increase restoration throughout the Delta.
Unfortunately, we've come to that point in the program when we have time for one last question.
I guess I'm the lucky one. I actually had a question for Jill Tidman. I'm curious if, apart from maybe donating money, what can people in the watershed cities do to help? Is there other ways? You said your organization both tries to raise money and awareness. So how can people help raise awareness about this issue?
Sure. Well, first let me say thanks to, and I can't remember your name, but this gentleman provided the music for the renewal video that you saw. So thank you for that. And Tom, who asked the question earlier, is a supporter of the campaign. So thank you for that, Tom. So there's a lot of people in this room that are already helping. But the Redford Center's film Watershed is available. We donate it to anybody that wants to do a local screening event. It's a 55-minute film, so it really was designed to be sort of a conversation starter. We've, to date, had about 450 local screenings with it, so that's, you know, a start. So that's one way to do it. I know that there's also opportunities down in the Delta to do volunteer work, and I've been down there and I've seen it, and it's fun, and I mean, it's a trip, but for people that don't live close by, but that's absolutely another way to do it.
This is Ann Clark at the Commonwealth Club, and I'd like to ask each of our speakers now to give us what they think is most important. I think that's a bad question to ask, actually, but what is really that they're most interested and hopeful for in the future. And why don't we start with you, Jill, and come down.
Sure. Well, I think for me, anytime we dive into an issue like this, because we're not the experts, it's really just a learning experience, and we get involved because there's a great need for more engagement. But once I get in, I always am so blown away by how much work is actually going on, how many smart, committed people are working on this stuff already, how much progress is being made. And unfortunately, we're just in this sort of media environment where we don't really hear the good news very often, but there is a lot of progress happening. And I think just for me, being, working alongside these guys who are doing the stuff on the ground, it's pretty amazing to see the level of care and thought and just experience that is actively doing this stuff. So I feel quite hopeful, frankly, and I think we've sort of surprised ourselves a little bit in how quickly we've reached our, almost reached our first fundraising target and all of the things that we've been able to accomplish, getting the pulse flow done, and we're sort of on track to do the very best we can. And I think that someday, I really do hope, I have young children and I want to take them down there someday to see this, this river flowing back in. I think it will.
Andrew Fulin,
So some people talk about water as the next oil, and people even talk about wars springing up around water. I'm actually a bit more hopeful about water. I think it's a thing that connects us. It's certainly always been a part of human nature to look at it as rejuvenating and restoring, and I think stories like this can be really hopeful. And so I guess my hope is that we start to develop a more connected relationship to water and therefore our natural world and our environment, and use that to sort of not only bridge divides between us and the environment, but hopefully with one another. And I think we're seeing that across the border, and hopefully we'll see that within the state of California and elsewhere.
And John Shepard, Ed, for you.
So first of all, I have to do a special shout out to Joel and the Redford Center, who have been so tremendous. The NGOs that work in this, we're kind of in the weeds, and sometimes we lose sight of the power of the story, and I think Joel has really helped us recapture the power of it. And the thing about Watershed that I really like is the way you were able to connect so many people who may be far away from the Colorado River or their source of water. You helped reconnect them to that. And even if we live upstream, we actually all live downstream, and we are all connected by water. And to me, that's, I think, the message that this experience has really driven home, working with you and the NGO partners. We all do live downstream and share the same water. So.
This is Ann Clark, and you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio and our program, Restoring the Mighty Colorado and Delta, Progress and Hope. A big thank you to all our panelists and all the work they do. And a big thank you to our audience here today and our radio and internet audiences. Again, our panel was John Shepard from the Sonoran Institute, Phoenix, Tucson, Arizona, Jill Tidman from the Redford Center, and Andrew Fulin, who is the Deputy Director of California Water Foundation. We want to give a special thanks to the Redford Center and to the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum for co-sponsoring this program. And Christy Deans, who is the Vice Chair, is with us tonight of the Business and Leadership Forum. Look for all of the Commonwealth Club programs at www.commonwealthclub.org. And check out our radio, video, and free streaming podcast. Remember, you can find our program on radio, video, and podcast, and watch programs on the California Channel Thursdays at 9 p.m. and on KRCB-TV, Channel 22, on Comcast and DirecTV at 11 a.m. the last Sunday of each month. Subscribe to our free podcasting service to automatically download a new program recording to your personal computer each week. To do this, go to commonwealthclub.org/podcast. I also want to remind everyone that we do have copies of Watershed, and I hope that you will get it. For me, as I mentioned, it's a really inspiring documentary. And the information in the brochure about Raise the River is really, really, I think, well done for all of us who know maybe just a little about this or who may know a lot. But Raise the River is really important for us to be able to continue all of this work that people are so dedicated for. And don't forget our holiday greeting celebration this Thursday evening. A toast to the wine harvest, sustainable practices, and California wine, co-sponsored by the Wine Institute. So if you pick up Watershed tonight and come to the event on Thursday, you will be in the holiday spirits. we wish you a happy holiday. We hope to see you on Thursday. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 111 years of enlightened discussion. And I always remind my adult children I have not been around 111 years. In the know is adjourned.